and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Iran conflict and the law. And Richard, towards the end of the holiday break that we're returning from, we had a series of dramatic events in the Middle East, started with a largely unsuccessful attack on the American embassy in Baghdad that was backed by Iran. And in response, a few days later, an American airstrike takes out Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Quds Force, who was the longtime mastermind of Iran's interventions in Iraq and all over the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And in addition to all the foreign policy debates this has spawned, which we can talk about, it's also touched off some legal ones. And so I'll start you with this. Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, a Democrat, this is what he said shortly afterwards on Twitter. The question is this, I'm quoting him, as reports suggest, did America just assassinate, without any congressional authorization, the second most powerful person in Iran, knowingly setting off a potential massive regional war? Close quote. Now, I guess there are actually two questions embedded in that, Richard. One is whether the Trump administration needed congressional authorization for the strike. And the second is whether Murphy is correct to characterize this as an assassination. I'll let you take those in whichever order you please.
Well, let's start with the second one. I think generally the definition of assassination is its actions which are illegal by the parties who undertake it. And so in order to make that claim, you have to go back and ask whether or not there's any justification. Now, normally it turns out that the ability to kill people depends at least in large part as to whether or not they're at war with you. In the old gallant days, in order for there to be a war, there had to be a declaration of war by somebody against somebody else. But it is very clear that both in terms of American constitutional practice on the one hand and world practice on the other, formal declarations of law are relatively infrequent. And so what happens is somebody attacks, and we call it a police action or we call it a small military engagement. We don't call them wars. Now, why do we do this? I think the major reason is actually quite technical. If you look at most various treaties, they require people to come to your assistance when you are attacked in a war. And so if you treat every small intervention of this sort, then you're going to have massive alliances coming to help you. And so the tendency is to give other nations the freedom to decide whether or not they wish to engage in this particular conflict by calling it something less than a war. And if you go to the United States, I think the last time that we actually declared war was 1941 with respect to what happened in with Germany and with the Japanese after Pearl Harbor. We never did declare war in Korea or in Vietnam or in any of the other conflicts that they're with. So I think what you have to do is to then say, was there a warlike act on the other side that might have justified the use of force? And I think the answer is, well, it depends on how you characterize bombing somebody's enemy, taking out your drones, and killing various kinds of people on the land. In olden days, any one of those activities would have been regarded as an act of war, so that if you wanted to declare war against them, you could. We don't want to escalate in this point by declaring formal wars, but can you respond to them? I think the answer to that question has to be yes, you can do this. Now, this then depends upon another very tricky term, which is whether or not this is an imminent threat of one kind or another. And it turns out the word imminence is being asked to do too much work under this particular type of situation. The simple point in this case is it's not that there was a threat to attack the American embassy in Baghdad, and not that there was a threat to take down a drone. It's that all these things were actually accomplished and caused physical damages and did somebody. So you don't have to ask about imminence. What you then have to ask about, are these sufficiently grave and sufficiently large that you can take this kind of dramatic response of knocking him out? And there are two ways to look at this, and it's a matter of strategy, I think, rather than a matter of legality. And I don't know which strategy is better. I don't think anybody at this point knows. But essentially, the first strategy is proportionate response. So physical force, which is used at a low level like the drone, you respond with a low-level thing. And then if it turns out that they attack your warfare bases, well, then you do a little bit of the same. And you slowly escalate, and the theory is that each time that you do this, they will now have a credible threat facing them, that if they decide to raise the ante, they know you will raise the ante. Now, Trump didn't follow that strategy. What he did with respect to all the other difficulties is he put into place financial sanctions of one kind or another. And then the moment they killed some human beings, what he did is he said, I'm not going to give this guy, Soleimani, a perfect immunity from various kinds of attack. And so he just took him out. Absolutely a sugar strike, the surgical strike. I don't even think they made a damage on the pavement with them. Completely transformed the world. Because now, in effect, they realize that there's nobody that's safe there. So what are they going to do? Well, they could raise the ante again. But if they do so, I think they now know they're going to be hit even harder. And the Trump position basically is, we've got the upper hand now. We don't want to wait to the point where they can achieve, at least on a local regime, some form of parity. So we're going in. I've just been reading the biography of Winston Churchill by this man, Andrew Roberts. And the one thing that is reminded to you when you look at that is, if France had decided to challenge the demilitarization of the Rhineland in 1936, there would have been no World War II. But they decided that it wasn't big enough to do this. So the point that I want to make is that there are two kinds of error in these cases, moving too fast and moving too slow. And every case is going to have at least some element of this. The tendency on the part of most people is to be extremely judgmental about the guy on the inside, even though you know that he has more information about what's going on than you do. In the case of Trump, he's mercurial. He doesn't listen to advice in many cases. There's a certain superficial attractiveness to this position. But I don't think you could go around saying, well, I don't like this particular man. I'm not going to show him any deference. If it turned out to be some credible Democrat, say Joe Biden, well, I certainly would give him deference. I think essentially what you have to do is to sort of ride this out, wait for there to be some clear sign of a debacle, of which there is none at this present point of time, which is why I think the market went up today. I think it went up until the end of the day, and somewhere in the middle of the day, Ms. Pelosi had this scheme to try to narrow the president down even more than he is. I think it's a bad idea. I think it will be vetoed. I think that it may well be that what Trump did is a mistake, but on the other hand, I'm comforted when I read somebody like David Petraeus, who says, you know, this is not so bad after all.
So, Richard, one of the other arguments that the Trump administration makes, they've put forth several justifications for what they did, but one of them is that the authorization for the use of military force, that AUMF is the acronym they use in Washington, that was used for the Iraq War and is still in effect, was sufficient legal justification for this because the strike did, after all, take place in Iraq. And there's also the post 9/11 AUMF against Al-Qaeda still in effect. And there has been a fair bit of criticism, especially as the years have passed, of relying on these old authorizations and using them as a catch-all for these kinds of activities. Let me read you something. This is actually from a conservative critic of it, Kevin Williamson, writing at National Review. Quote, the 2001 and 2002 authorizations have served their purposes. They're open-ended enabling acts, and they should be repealed and replaced, if they must be replaced, with an instrument that is much more narrowly tailored and takes into account the current political and security realities, which are not what they were nearly 20 years ago, close quote. So the criticism here is that this is really Congress surrendering the field. They like to complain about the president in situations like this, but they've left the statutory device that empowers him on the books. So you've now got people like Barbara Lee in the House, for example, proposing that this AUMF for Iraq be repealed. How do you react to that line of argument?
Well, I think one of the difficulties that you start to see with this argument is not one that was raised. It's, you know, to some extent, there's at least a weak causal relationship to what was done that prompted 9/11 and all the stuff that comes afterwards. And so the further you go, the more links there are in the chain of causation, making it less likely that anything you do is going to be a response to anything in 9/11. And in this particular case, you don't have Al-Qaeda involved in this situation. You don't have anybody who was associated with these activities. What you do is you have essentially the Iranian government with impunity that marches back and forth around the land. And I do not think myself that the AUMF would be sufficient authorization to go after him. So what you then have to do is to say, well, what about this nebulous field known as inherent powers of the president in order to deal with these kinds of things and make it into a much more constitutional debate. And here you go back to the earliest periods of time, and it's very clear that everybody did not believe, everybody firmly rejected the proposition that you had to submit a declaration of war when you were attacked by a foreign nation. Now, they were thinking of, like, the War of 1812, where the British come on the thing and they attack Fort McHenry in Baltimore. And then what you do is, in all of these things, the attack gets a little bit smaller, and the justifications of self-defense get a little bit weaker. So what you're done is you're left with a major proposition, which it's very difficult to apply in this particular case. I do not think that this is a source of dispute that should be resolved by litigation. I think it has to be resolved to some extent by a negotiation of one kind or another. So I think that the AUMF is irrelevant to the current situation. I do agree with that. But I also think that the basic constitutional dilemma is one that is not clearly resolved. As I mentioned earlier in this show, the American practice has moved very powerfully in favor of a rule which essentially allows for executive action in the face of various kinds of peril. And the most interesting version of this is the Harold Coe version. Harold was a very distinguished scholar at Yale Law School and the dean. And when he was out of office, what he always said is, you've got to get these authorizations. You have to bind the executive. They're going to commit you to all sorts of terrible things that you can't extricate yourself from. And then he goes and he starts to work for none other than Barack Obama, noted pacifist, which he's not. And so what they do is they decide to shoot in Libya. And the argument that Coe made that this was okay or consistent with his previous position was, I think, farcical. He said, well, we're only shooting at them and they're not able to shoot at us. And so it doesn't look to me like it's a war. Well, a one-sided war is a war as far as I'm concerned. And so what it does is it shows you when the Democrats are in power, they basically want to relax the rules. Then when they're out of power and in control of at least one half of Congress, they want to put them in there. I'm much more of the view that you have to have a consistent position. And I think that the constitutional practice has actually overridden the constitutional text. I mean, you know, this is the kind of position that you see by many public international lawyers raising this kind of argument. And I don't think that you could discard it. And I certainly don't think that you could resort it on a criminal side if you've now had basically 70 years of consistent practice. And you want to say the only guy who cannot take advantage of that is one Donald J. Trump.
Okay, so if we clearly don't have a consensus around a limiting principle for that kind of executive flexibility on this stuff as a matter of practice, is there one in your mind? I mean, where would you draw the lines in an ideal world as to where what point the president – the line that the president can't cross before he has to go to Congress on these issues?
God, I wish I knew, but I will give you the kind of case that always has troubled me. President Trump decides that Mr. Putin has become very obdurate. And so what he does is he authorizes a nuclear attack on Moscow out of nothing. I think, in effect, that that's probably something which is utterly beyond the pale and is the kind of major intervention for which the War Power Declaration being lodged in Congress was designed to deal with. And so what you're kind of doing, in effect, is as follows. You're using the informal authorization system for, quote, unquote, proportionate, whatever that means, and we don't know what it means, responses to localize the effects, but we require the declaration of war when there's a major theater of operation which you used to open up, and certainly if you wish to open it up with respect to nuclear weapons. So that's the kind of the place that I would start to do this. And notice I didn't just invent this test for this particular case. I sort of held to it for a fairly long time. Trump is on the right side of that particular line. Now, will it result in a debacle because of the assassination? Well, I don't think that's the case. This is what I see. Is I think for the first time, the president of the United States has basically given a credible threat that he will use very substantial force if they want to engage in very substantial activities. So I think the Iranians will be extremely cautious in the way in which they want to escalate this thing, because if they do, I think Trump will treat this as an open invitation for us to basically take our aircraft carriers and our various planes and wipe out the Iranian Air Force and Navy, which I think they can do. It's also the case, I mean, I don't want to see this happen in the short run, but I think it becomes plausible, is we have these bunker buster bombs, which I gather under the explosives, we can basically have impact without detonation, and these things can burrow their way through 100 or 200 feet of concrete or something like that by devices that are all secured, maybe little bombs before big bomb. And, you know, you could probably take out some fraction of their military atomic capabilities under these circumstances. So we then go back to the larger question, why did this happen? And as you know, I was a vigorous opponent of the Iranian deal that Barack Obama made. I think the nuclear deterrent issue is less important than the conventional weapons stuff, because you can use conventional weapons and intrigue in small doses that are big enough to really kill people, whereas if you try to use a nuclear weapon, you know what's going to happen to you on the opposite end, and so you're not going to do that, but you will do this. And when he basically said, I'm putting everything on the nuclear deal, I didn't believe it. I mean, if the Iranians say we're in full compliance with the contract when there's no independent inspection, I regard that as a figment of your imagination. So I think, in effect, that was the most lopsided, stupid arrangement that he ever did, with the possible exception of the deal that he made in Syria, where he said, oh, we could stop the problem of nerve gas and stuff like that. Just give it over to the Russians, and we will not use force. I think the willingness not to use force in cases where it's fairly justified has a huge cost, because everybody on the other side is think they're going to have a free hand. And that's exactly what Salami did, right? He thought nobody was going to touch him. He could broadcast his whereabouts wherever he was going because he was invincible. They had cowed the Americans. And I, to some extent, think that the willingness to break that set of expectations may be a long-term positive effect. Nobody knows for sure. So I'm giving, if you ask me to give probabilities on this, which way it's likely to work out, plus or minus for the United States and for world peace, I'm at 2-1 saying that it will probably be correct. And there are many people out there who are 5-1 in the other direction. And frankly, I just don't get it.
One side issue I'll ask you about as we exit, partially because I think we're in our 8th or 9th year of doing the show. There's not a lot of topics that we've never addressed, but this, I believe, is one of them. And I raise it more for that reason than because it's a live issue. But there was an online panic in the aftermath of these attacks that the World War III was going to be upon us. And the Selective Service website ended up crashing because so many young people were looking for information on the draft. Now, there's really nothing to suggest that's going to happen, and we're almost 50 years removed now from the last time that the draft was used. But as we exit today, give us the classical liberal position on the concept of the federal government conscripting young men for military service.
Well, I mean, this actually came up, and you know who is my favorite justice?
Oh, you're asking me this question?
Yeah.
It's one of the obscure late 19th century justices.
No, early 20th century. It's Mallon Pitney. Yeah.
All right. See.
He actually wrote the Selective Service cases in 1917. And those cases had two parts to them. The first part was whether or not when you were faced with a war in Europe, which did not fall within the limited purposes of the militia clause, it was not designed to suppress rebellion or invasion, or insurrection. It was only designed to do the fact that you can't call up the militia. So what Wilson did is he drafted everybody in the militia and put them into the army. And Pitney, as a libertarian, said, that's fine. It's clearly wrong as a constitutional matter. If you want to have two separate branches of government where the state militia is designed to be a counterweight to the federal government, you can't decide how to neutralize it by just pulling them in. And Pitney did basically the following situation. This is wartime, baby. We don't have any role whatsoever to play in this particular thing. And I'm sure what he thought is what I thought now. Just, you know, reading this Churchill biography, you also get to World War I as well as to World War II, is that Wilson made such a mess of this situation going into the draft situation that if you really wanted to treat the militia as a separate thing from the army, well, we'll just happen to lose the First World War because we won't be able to get anybody over there in time. And I think you also remember that, you know, it takes 6 months to deploy, and the Germans were actually in the lead when the American troops came in and turned the balance. So that was the first thing. The second thing he talked about was the draft. And the question as to whether or not conscription is essentially an interference with the liberty of an ordinary citizen to conduct his or her life in accordance with their own dictates. And his attitude on that was unremittingly hostile. And he says, we have the survival of a country at stake, and the safety of the people is the supreme law, to go back to my other great source of wisdom, the Roman law. And I'm not going to sit here as a court and allow any claims to deal with the military to get any purchase. So this was decided 2 years after he essentially decided that in labor negotiations, employers have an absolute right not to deal with unions. I think he's correct on that. So I think what happens is if you take Pitney and realize that he is the leading exemplar of individual liberty, and he comes down thunderously on the other side, what you have to do is to kind of say that, you know, the Constitution was written against the kind of background of a lot of complicated social practices, one of which was essentially to allow conscription. Now, Milton Friedman wants the voluntary army, and I want the voluntary army, so it's not at all clear that this is the right approach. But essentially, what it did is it became an argument for complete judicial nullification. That is, the nullification of judicial power with respect to military activities. And I think that that opinion was decided 103 years ago. And it would come out exactly the same way today. The only areas that we've had interference with the draft is the Equal Protection Clause and how we put women into the army and so forth. And if you were rigorous about the Equal Protection Clause and said women had to be 50% of every branch of service everywhere in the United States, I don't think you could run an army on that. I think essentially if the ratio is 85-15, that probably tells you what you need. It's certainly the case if you look at the Israeli army, which is very egalitarian in some sense. They certainly have very well-specific sex-defined roles and so forth. So I don't think the equal protection line is something that you should ever use to overcome the discretion line. I realize that I'm not going to win many, many friends on this, but I think the effort to try and use gender as a way to modify and alter American foreign policy and military policy is a mistake. And I say that as somebody who thinks it's extremely important that you make very active activities to recruit women into the military services, because they can do certain wells every bit as well as men and free up more men for combat. Do I think there's a difference? Yes. Do the Israelis think there's a difference? Yes. How do we know this? Well, you cannot give a heavy caliber weapon to a woman that you could give to a man because she's not strong enough to hold it. And you know, you just have to understand these kinds of things. And so I think in the answers, I just want to keep the whole constitutional thing out of this. And I would say that the draft is purely wholly constitutional today. And the willingness of the government or the courts to override the composition of the military force is essentially zero. In fact, in 1931 and then later in 1952, they did pass additional statutes which essentially created dual service obligations so that people could be put into both the army and into the militia. And that stuff held for a very long period in time until we had the Purpich case, where the question was whether or not we could take folks in the in the militias and use them to fight against the Contras in Honduras or in Nicaragua or some such place. And the answer was, in the end, the Supreme Court said, of course you can do this. I was actually a lawyer on this case. No way you would know this, at least involved in it. I told the National Guard that they should essentially do the following thing, is to admit that the Army could do whatever what it wants, but that you, the militia, and you, the National Guard, have a separate line of appropriation so that when these people are not called up into federal services, you can essentially get federal support for their activities. So that's the way in which I think about that. And this is a last question. You did not know my peculiar expertise on this, right? But starting... What?
I didn't, but I assume your particular expertise in everything, Richard.
Well, I mean, it was July 9. I mean, I can still remember the call in July. I'll tell you this last story because I think it captures it. There was a general in the National Guard Air Corps retired because the Army could not work these things. And he calls me up. He says, Professor Epstein, he says, we've been told that you're an expert on the militia clauses. So I look into the phone and I said, what's the militia clause? And he looks into the phone back at me. He says, you know, the militia clauses. And I look back at him. I said, I have heard of the Second Amendment, but I don't think that's what you're talking about. He says, no, I'm talking about the militia clauses. I said, well, tell me what they are. It turns out it's actually an extremely difficult proposition because it's the only provisions in Article One where you have a self-conscious dual split in the control over a militia between the federal government and the state government. So I told him perfectly honestly. Is that, I mean, I know nothing about this subject, but like David Boies, it's short. I can read it. You send me the stuff. If I think I could help you, I will charge you for my time. If I think that I can't, I won't. And then I worked for them for a year until they essentially took the wrong line at the Supreme Court level, and I was then left stranded. So it was a glorious story while it lasted. And then it just ended. I think, in effect, the lesson there is pretty clear as to what's going on. The federal government today can determine, A, the draft, and B, the mix and the composition of the militias on the one hand and the federal government on the federal army on the other hand.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org. You can also follow him on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.